Let's ride, let's ride, let's ride. Welcome back to the Let's Ride podcast. We have a solo episode where it's just Matt and I, and we've had a little hiatus here lately. Believe it or not, hosting a podcast weekly is a lot tougher than it sounds from a logistics standpoint, but we're back and we're excited about it. Matt, tell us how the high school season at Cherry Creek wrapped up and how the Colorado season is coming to an end here.
Well, sure. First off, you know, we do have our issues with always trying to find the time slots. You with a 9-to-5 job on the East Coast and me with what we'll call a 5 to 9 p.m. job, mountain time. So not always the easiest, but unfortunately, my Cherry Creek season has come to an end. An OT loss in the playoffs. Sad ending, not the way we wanted things to go. I want to make sure to give a shout out to my sister, Casey, who coaches at Colorado Academy out here in Colorado. And yesterday I watched her win her second straight state championship as an assistant coach there and the program's 7th straight state championship. So when you want to talk about a juggernaut, I know we had Taylor Cummings on here talking about McDonough girls lacrosse and what they've done. Colorado Academy is secretly out here just completely dominating the competition and one of the best teams I've seen for high school lacrosse period. And I think they only had one senior on that squad with tons of young talent. So my guess is they'll be back there again. But like all things now, we are, you know, slowly wrapping up the college lacrosse season and for high school, making our way from that transition from high school lacrosse to the ever important club summer season.
And there's no break, Matt. There's no break. There's no time to put the stick down for these kids or put the whistle down for the coaches. It's ridiculous. I'm helping out down here at the 91 with Flanagan and even with some of the other organizations in the area. I think they drop the stick for like 24 hours and then pick it back up for the club season. So what's that like for you and for the kids you coach? I mean, what's the biggest challenge in turning it around that quick?
Well, there really isn't a break. And if you're in a state where maybe you end a little sooner, I mean, my biggest advice for these kids is even if it's a week, if it's 3 days, just to make sure to actually use it, right? Actually take that break. Everyone's finishing their spring season of practicing every day or almost every day. So, you know, skills should be sharp and IQ level should be high and everyone should be in good lacrosse shape. So I tell the guys who do have a break to make sure to take advantage of it. And at this point, right, summer seasons are already set for a lot of players. And I try to help influence my high school guys to make sure that they're not overloading their summers. A lot of kids are out there playing in 6-7 tournaments and trying to go to every single event during the week or on weekends that they have a break. It's also important to make sure that you find the time to have a break during the summer season as well. June is super intense with recruiting, with events, with tournaments. And the one really nice thing that NCAA did was they blacked out recruiting during the 4th of July. So I'm trying to tell my guys to make sure that they're doing the same thing and making sure our teams aren't competing in tournaments around that time. So that's kind of like a midsummer break in and of itself, and that the players are doing the right thing and making sure that they're taking that time to enjoy themselves and catching a breather from lacrosse. Because it really is, once you get rolling with your spring season into that summer season, there's not many opportunities for rest. So you got to find the ones that you can and make sure you're taking advantage of it.
Yeah, I think to your point, I mean, from a college coach's perspective, it's like get to the July 4th break. It gives you a nice couple of days to unwind and take a little bit of a break. And then, you know, you kind of have those 3 weeks after that to finish out and make sure you finish strong and you feel good going into the fall. But to your point, it's easier said than done to put the stick down and to take a break, even if it's just a week. And if my fear for some of these like high school kids that have been doing this since like second or third grade is that, you know, that was kind of hockey for me, you know, but I got to like later in my high school career and I was like, I'm spent. I love this game, but it's just become, you know, too much of a job. And from a lacrosse standpoint, I mean, I started playing in eighth grade. So when I was like a senior in college, it was still relatively new. I was still learning new things. I hadn't been like run through the gauntlet. And even at that time, I mean, I played in one summer tournament. So there wasn't the club scene. So much has changed. And I think my fear for some of these kids is just they get burned out at too young of an age and they're not focused on the fun of this whole thing. And also, you know, you don't have time to be a kid if you're off at eight tournaments and seven prospect days. And then you have like 2 weeks before fall starts. And if you're playing a fall sport, you're right in those trenches. So any advice for the parents of even your players and the high school kids around the country?
Well, I try to talk to the parents and the kids all the time, and I try to come up with a schedule that makes the most sense, right? The question that you hear all the time is what's happening to the multi-sport athletes? Well, it's guys like me who run club programs that are making these kids play so much year round that are kind of taken away from that opportunity and ability to play multiple sports. So what I try to do with our youth players is your summer season is the month of June. You're in and out. It's intense. It's an intense 4 weeks, but you're done. And then you can pursue other things in July and other sports and get a rest maybe before your fall sports kick in. And for the high school guys, it's making sure we're going to good events in June so they're getting seen. But we take a full 10 days off in the end of June to through the beginning of July, like July 10th. And then we finish up with a couple tournaments in the middle of July, which one, I hope they're taking that breather and taking advantage of it and taking that break, but also giving them a couple weeks before the fall season, whatever that may be. And if it's not playing a fall sport, then actually having a break before you start up again with your fall lacrosse. So I think it's important, you know, and I'm trying to get these kids recruited, but I'm also trying to make sure that they can also be high schoolers or youth players and enjoy summer experiences outside of lacrosse. So I think it's important that parents, you know, take a look at that schedule and making sure that they're giving kids this opportunity to be well-rounded. And if they are full-time lacrosse guys, that's great too, but making sure that you are taking breaks and doing other things and being a kid and having some fun summer experiences. Just like myself. I just announced that I'm not going back to the PLL to coach this summer. And that's after 14 years straight of being involved in pro lacrosse as a player, as a coach, as a team president, and realized that I didn't have any free weekends in the summer since I graduated college. Right. So to date myself at 36 years old, this will be the first time I have a few free weekends, and they're few and far between. There's not a ton of them, but I am going to take advantage of them, starting with this weekend, going with my girlfriend and dogs to Steamboat up to the mountains to relax, do some fishing and hanging out.
Yeah, you don't get up there much, man. I feel bad for you. You're not in the mountains ever. I agree with you, man. And I think that's a great model that you have for your guys. And I think, you know, guys like Flanagan down here do a good job of it too. I mean, it's the same kind of model. It's probably like 5 weeks, maybe 5 weeks straight, pretty intense. And but I think about my summers as a kid, and it's like, you know, you're running across the street to the pool, you're hanging out at your buddy's house, you're riding your bike all over the place. And I mean, you're playing lacrosse in the backyard, but nothing structured about that. And you're basically just having fun playing pig and pickup games and backyard football. And I think that they're, you know, you're not going to change it. It's never going to be like that. But I think these kids and their parents need to understand that you're an anomaly. You know, like lacrosse has been your life, will continue to be your life, but a lot of these kids are going to go on and do different things, and their focus needs to be enjoying the sport and learning as much as they can about themselves through the sport. But anyway, well, let's move on. I don't want to, you know, we sound a little holier than thou in terms of what we've done, and a little bit of hypocritical, but it's an important piece to keep that perspective and understand that you have options and that you don't need to do the same thing as what the guy to your right or your guy to your left is doing. You know, even though going to that prospect day sounds like something you can't miss, typically it is something you can miss. And the last thing I'll say about that is it's so important to have an ally that knows college coaches and that has relationships and understands the landscape that you can go to and say, hey, like, should I go to this? And they can give you an honest answer. But then from there, it's about you listening to that mentor of yours and having trust in that person and valuing that relationship enough to not just seek out the advice, but act upon it and then go on and have fun the rest of your summer or take a few days off if that's what you're being advised to do. Let's talk about the Final Four.
Yeah, Final Four is looking great. After I sat around this past weekend being sad and lonely after my Cherry Creek High School season ended. And the one nice thing about that was that I had the opportunity to watch all the quarterfinal games to get a sense of what these matchups look like in the Final Four this upcoming weekend in Hartford, Connecticut. And we'll get rolling with the first one, Maryland versus Princeton. That's the first one I have on my list. Maryland, the absolute juggernaut that everyone's talking about this year. And Princeton, kind of the forgotten team that, you know, we had the Princeton coaches on early in the season, and they were looking great, a strong two or three seed that happened to lose some games late in the season and actually sat out during the Ivy League tournament, but had some nice wins rolling in, and now they get a rematch with a Maryland team, and that is looking very sharp. And so we have that game on first. So what are your thoughts looking into Maryland versus Princeton right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to toot my own horn real quick. I said I had my eye on Princeton before they beat Georgetown. We weren't even in the top 20, I don't think. But, you know, I saw them play Binghamton really early in the year, and I was like, this team moves the ball so well. They're well-organized. They're tough and physical on defense, which I think the jury was still out on at that point. But you watch them play, you know, Yale, and they were really the more physical team in that game, and they were bullying Yale at points there. And being physical when they slid, being physical on the ball. They have a really, really great rope unit. You know, I was down in Charleston this past weekend, so I didn't watch all the games, but I was glued to a TV down in Charleston to watch Coach Hirsch, you know, earn his trip to the Final Four. And now the, you know, to have this matchup against Maryland, I think is a really cool thing, because they were a different team the first time that they played Maryland. And I don't, you know, Maryland is so good. They are so complete. They take advantage of every team's mistakes, you know, but you look at like how they're beating teams, and it's like the substitution games, the possession, they're crushing teams in the possession battle because they're winning faceoffs and they're just so efficient offensively, that it's just not a team you can have mistakes against. And, you know, they clear well. They don't ride a ton, but they clear really well. They are efficient offense. They share the ball. The same old story that everyone's saying about Maryland. But I do think that, you know, if Princeton plays a clean game and doesn't beat themselves, they're going to put themselves in a position to at least make it more of a game than what we've seen from Maryland's games to this point. I mean, they haven't really had any close games. Closest one was Notre Dame, a couple goals. And other than that, it was Princeton, right?
Yeah, four goals against Princeton.
Yeah, so I'm excited for this one. I think you have two teams that know who they are. I think Princeton's obviously the less experienced team, but had some growing pains where they have learned some hard lessons. And now they're playing with house money a little bit. I don't know if they feel that way, but back in the Final Four for the first time in a while. And I think I'm hoping that this is a better game than some people are anticipated being. And yet, you know, a great goalie, you got a great close D, great rope unit, and a pretty well-balanced offense with Princeton. With Maryland, you just have a more experienced team that has not shown the ability to let up for, you know, a possession, let alone a quarter or a game. So work cut out for Princeton, but an exciting matchup. And I'm more excited about this Final Four than I think that some people are. What about you?
Yeah, I think it's funny what you mentioned, right? I'm pretty sure Maryland, four of their first nine goals were in the subbing game, catching UVA off guard in that quarterfinal matchup and scoring 6-on-5, 5-on-4 type opportunities. The one thing that I do like in Princeton's favor is the fact that they do share the ball well. And for Maryland, it was so easy for them, which is crazy, that they just completely took Moore and Schellenberger out of that game with their defenders. And UVA, a team that, you know, also shares the ball well, has two superstars and those two players that can usually beat their man and get a step and generate some offense. But that close unit for Maryland really is something else. And one-on-one matchups, you're just not going to win those, especially their defensive midfielders. All of them got drafted. You just don't win those one-on-one matchups as much. But that's why I like Princeton with their ball movement. Eric Peters is a goalie we talked about when we had the Princeton coaches on here. He had 17 saves this past weekend against Yale, and he's going to need to have maybe 20 to 22 saves for Princeton to have a chance in this game, which is something realistic for him to do if the Princeton defense plays the way they do and give Eric the opportunity to see the shots he wants to see. He can make those saves. And it's funny that you mentioned that Maryland's not a team that rides extremely well. It's probably because they're just used to scoring so much. Riding isn't really something that's involved in their game as much. So hopefully that gives Princeton an opportunity to make saves, clear the ball the first time. You mentioned you can't make mistakes against them. You have to clear the ball every single time. You have to steal a couple faceoffs from Maryland, which is not something that's easy either, which is really going to come down to some wing play and some tough GBs, which Pace Billings, that LSM for Princeton, has the opportunity to do. But yeah, I think Eric Peters is going to have to make a lot of saves for this game to happen. And I'm still picking Maryland, but I mean, that's obviously the easy choice, but I'm certainly rooting for Princeton, like to see them win it. My only thing that I had about this game, something that's come up, is Maryland's the absolute number one seed, but they're playing in the 2:30, which is actually the later time slot. And anyone who's played Memorial Day weekend or watch knows that every single minute of recovery that you can get between the semifinal game and the championship game on Monday is completely needed. So my question is, why is the number one team getting a later time slot? Shouldn't they be rewarded for what they've done all season and maybe be a little bit earlier? I mean, this in 2007, this worked to my advantage. We were the lower seed. We played in the first game, and Duke, being the highest seed, played in the later game, and they came out in the first half and they were clearly tired from an absolutely epic battle against Cornell, a team we're about to talk about here in a second. But I'm not sure why the one seed plays in the second game. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I heard Clark say it on the broadcast. I think it was him. You know, it doesn't make any sense that these games are played in a 48-hour turnaround either. I want to see two clean. Every game is like, I would take the under on every championship game because, and not that that's the case every year, but these kids are tired. They're tired. They're worn down. Some of them aren't very deep programs. You know, and you need two midfields, you know, and you need two healthy midfields. You lose a guy, that's a huge deal on that weekend. 48 hours is not a ton of time to turn around and recover, to your point, but there's a short list of the things that are kind of just asinine in the sport. And I think this is one of them. I think this one of them would be the crease, the goal mouth issue. The third one would be starting the season on time. And I just don't think that the coaches have enough time to allocate to making these changes. You have some coaches that are investing as much time as they possibly can, but I don't believe in any other sport you're asking current coaches to drive the bus on making sure that changes that need to be made especially in a sport that is evolving so much, from a participation standpoint, from an on the field play standpoint. You need a group of people that understand the game, but have their finger on the pulse of the game and where it's headed to start to evaluate these things a little bit harder and to really put some thought into how do we need to change some things in the sport to make sure that it continues to move in the right direction. If I was John Tillman, I'd be pretty angry, not because I play the second spot, but because it's been such a consistent theme for Maryland in the Final Four. I mean, they almost always get the second spot, and it's not great, but cool second matchup here with Cornell and Rutgers. Your thoughts on that one?
I think this is going to be a great game. I think there's going to be a lot of goals, which people want to see, and two cool storylines, right? You have Cornell going back for the first time since, I think I read, 2013, with Connor Busick at the helm, first year head coach, young coach, a lot of energy. And then Rutgers, a team that's done things differently than everybody else, tons of transfers on the roster. I think they said 15 transfers on the roster, and going to the Final Four for the first time. I really love the storyline of Colin Kirst, the Rutgers goalie, going against his brother, CJ Kirst, the Cornell attackman, CJ being a great goal scorer. And the goalie, just a guy who stood on his head in the first two rounds of the tournament. And now they get to go head to head. For me, this reminds me of,
and apparently that the goalie has done a great job in big moments, championship games, playoffs, like his save percentage goes way up in those moments. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how playing his brother in that moment either continues on that trend or maybe, you know, that would be weird. I don't even have a brother, but thinking about playing my brother or even a close friend on that stage, he probably feels like a little bit of a lose-lose, exciting, but it's like either I win or he wins, one of us loses. This is, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it's something else. And I think, you know, Kirst, the attackman, showed the ability to release shots from all angles, both hands, high to low, low to high, everything. And Kirst, the goalie, shows quick hands, the ability to save high, save low. So I think that's just going to be an awesome like chess match between the two of them, like changing up the shots, how the goalie's going to make those saves. And just, I mean, you can't help but like smile at your brother if you save his shot, or vice versa if you score on him. This reminds me of, like, it's rare to get such a like direct matchup too, in terms of an attackman and a goalie. But I remember I went to the Final Four in 2001, and we used to go all the time as a family, but John Glatzel, the defender for Syracuse, was a first team All-American and I believe defender of the year. And he actually matched up on Tom Glatzel, his twin brother, who was a first team All-American attackman for Notre Dame. And they matched up on each other at the Final Four. It was the first time Notre Dame had ever been to the Final Four. You have the arguably attackman of the year besides Mike Powell being on that Syracuse roster versus the defender of the year, and they're twin brothers. Like, I remember watching that game and just thinking that was the coolest thing ever. And I have my older brother, Mike, who plays attackman. Besides matching up in practice, we were typically on the same team, so we never went head-to-head until we played in an MLL All-Star game, and we matched up on each other for a little bit. And that was an All-Star game, so it's different. I couldn't help. I think we were laughing the entire time. It was like, all right, I'll let you score a goal if you let me land a check, that kind of thing. But head-to-head matchup like this, I mean, I just think it's so cool, and so cool for this Kirst family that, like, every time you tune into one of their games, one of the brothers is doing something. The whole family's in the crowd. The mom's there at the game. Like, this is just a special moment for an epic family that, you know, I just think is a great storyline for this game that maybe some people, unfortunately, just aren't really that maybe as interested in.
Yeah. You just reminded me of the only moment I've ever had like that. Ryan Young was, I got caught on defense in an All-Star game, and Ryan Young had the ball at X, and he just absolutely broke me down. Like, I fell on my face. It was after a long night out the night before, and it was funny. Well, but
what do you mean, the night before a game?
Only in an All-Star.
Oh, okay.
Only in an All-Star game. But yeah, then I said, oh, you won't get back on defense. Sure enough, somehow I play on, get stuck on defense again. I'm clearing the ball and he's riding. I'm like, get in. And so he does, he gets in, and I wind up like, I'm just gonna crank it off of his face mask, and he just ducks and hits the deck. And it was a fun back and forth. But yeah, Colin and CJ are going to have a blast in that venue. I think the coolest thing about this game is the coaching staffs of both teams. Brian Brecht, the progress that he's made at Rutgers, and just the mountain that he's had to climb to get there. I mean, where was Rutgers before he took that program over? And where was Siena when he left? I mean, he left Siena and they were going to the NCAA tournament and challenging some pretty big time programs. He leaves, you know, they're okay, but you know, he did a phenomenal job at a program with no resources, goes into Rutgers where they're not having much success, turns that around. He's probably been the biggest snub in the NCAA tournament, you know, pretty consistently for years now. And now he breaks through and he's going to the Final Four, and he's always done things a little bit differently. Like, you know, I still remember at a recruiting event, I said, Coach, you're doing some really cool things. I'd love to sit down with you sometime, talk about what you're doing in transition, like that NASCAR stuff when Jim Mitchell was there. And he's like, you know, we're just trying to be different. We're just trying to be tough to prepare for, because he knew that he had to do that in order to have success in that conference. And just really cool to see the emotion on his face breaking through at the end of that game. I mean, you get chills, you know, thinking about a guy that's put so many years into something and to finally have some success. And then, you know, on the other side, and really the flip side completely, is Busick and Jordan Stevens and that staff, you know, being at that young and still motivating their players to get all the way to this point. I mean, pretty cool. And two really good programs to play the right way. I think it's going to be an incredible game. I would give Rutgers the slight advantage with just their experience. You know, I think they have a little bit more firepower. I mean, CJ Kirst is incredible, but you know, I think Rutgers has a bunch of dynamic Dodgers. They got big guys that are physical. They got smaller, quick guys. I think they can break you down in transition. They can break you down in 6-on-6 and have shown the ability to play some really good lacrosse, you know, end to end, which I think is a huge thing. Face-offs will be a key, just like they were in that, just like they'll be in the other semifinal, but just a really cool, intriguing matchup for the fans to watch. And I know it's not as sexy of a matchup from a name standpoint, but like the level of lacrosse that's going to be played in that game is going to be awesome. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I like Knobloch, the middie for Rutgers too. He's got both hands. Just a fun player to watch. And I think, to be honest, that Rutgers is the team that's going to give Maryland the best go on Monday between those matchups. I mean, Maryland has beat them up twice, but that third time's the charm. Being a team three times in one season is not the easiest thing in the world to do. That's why I'm hoping it's a Rutgers-Maryland Big Ten matchup in that championship. But before you play in the Final Four, right, you got to play in those quarterfinals to get there. And one of the things that became huge on Twitter was everyone talking about the venues, especially playing in Ohio State's football stadium that is known as one of the most epic, if not the coolest college football venue to play in, holds close to 110,000 people, but there was about 3,500 at that game. So without Ohio State being in the quarterfinals, hosting at Ohio State really doesn't make a whole lot of sense in my opinion. So now just kind of talking about the quarterfinals and where they should be held. I'm totally in the belief that you have to have one at a traditional hotbed that's going to have great attendance no matter what. Hofstra is always a good venue. I know the attendance was slightly lower than they expected. I think it was just over 5,000, maybe somewhere in that range, the 5,000 to 7,000. I think that's something that you should come to expect over the quarterfinals, unless you really luck out with the home site also having that home team playing there. So in my mind, Hofstra is a great venue. Navy obviously is a phenomenal venue. I got to play in a quarterfinal there my junior year. But the cool thing about that was that Navy was in the quarterfinals. So we actually went head to head with Navy at Navy in what was already one of the better rivalries in college lacrosse, Hopkins Navy. So I think that had about 18,000, which at the time was a quarterfinal record, and obviously Hopkins Navy, that all happened to work out. So Hofstra, Navy, I even think Johns Hopkins, you know, those stadiums that are in that 7,000 to 10,000 range, I feel like are great. But Ohio State was a swing and a miss by the NCAA. You know, maybe if they played at what I believe is Jesse Owens Stadium, which is smaller lacrosse venue on campus. I think that there needs to be a change in the process of where you're thinking. And in my mind, I like the MLS stadiums. I kind of believe in the same idea of pro lacrosse doing the same thing. Those venues that are, you know, maybe 6,000 to 15,000 range in a cool sports city, doesn't necessarily have to be on a college campus, is kind of where I'm at mentally. And the place that I just want to see an outdoor lacrosse game in Portland, Oregon. You know, you see what they've done with soccer, and that they're always sold out, that the fans are really into it. I think some of the keys there are, it's a great sports city. It might be a smaller, like class B size type city, but it has great sports fans, great tradition of sports fans.
Pick a side, Matt.
Sports. What's that?
Pick a side. You want to go hotbeds? You want to go Portland?
I'm saying one of each. You get two venues.
Yeah, but then who do you decide? gets the, I mean, you're talking about, you're either putting a premium on the experience that the coaches and the players and the viewers have, being at like that big time stadium and making sure that things packed, or you're talking about growing the game and being in a cool sports town that doesn't necessarily get to see lacrosse all the time. I understand what you're saying conceptually, but I don't, and I don't agree with anybody getting on, like, we don't know the process for this. Like, I think it's silly that people get on and want to complain about it, because it's like, well, Ohio State probably pushed for a bid pretty heavily, which is why they were supported and they were given a location. And I don't know anything about how the process works, but I would say you're either going to put, like I said, a premium on allowing people in a certain location the opportunity to see a Division I sports men's lacrosse game firsthand and believe that that's going to grow the game, or you're looking for the best experience for the in-person viewer and the and more importantly the players and the coaches and the schools themselves. And so I would lean in that side, because I don't think that we're moving the needle much by going to a non-traditional place and putting together a lacrosse game. I understand that, but what's driving the sports growth is, in my opinion, is the TV exposure and the fact that the games are on ESPN2 and ESPNU and ESPN and these big time networks, not like, you know, ESPN Plus, or when you're not casually scrolling down the TV guide that you don't run into it. And I know that firsthand. That's why I picked up a stick in eighth grade. You know, we started watching the Final Four because that was the only time we could see it, back when Princeton was playing in it consistently, and Syracuse and Navy and these, you know, Hawkins. And so I think I would agree with what you said initially. I think it needs to be wherever the higher seed is in the quarterfinals, and let the visiting fan base come and blow it up and make it awesome. Because if that's on TV, people are going to see that. Oh my goodness. Like, this is an event. This isn't just a game. This stands are packed. This looks awesome. I wish I was there. Like, that's what I feel like you need people on TV seeing it and saying to themselves, like, and then maybe they book a trip to the Final Four because they're like, this looks incredible. It looks like a cool event and experience, not just a lacrosse is on television and there's 70,000 empty seats.
Well, I mean, I'm with you on that, but if it's all about TV and lacrosse is doing a great job of getting on TV, I just feel like now you could take a risk. Like, Ohio State isn't a risk. You knew, even if they had 10,000 people there, which they were never going to have, I don't even know if they hit that if Ohio State is playing in the game, but it's Columbus, Ohio. It's a massive football stadium, and like you said, it looks empty on TV. If there was 10,000 people there, it'd look a little better, of course, but it just didn't look right on TV. So I feel like if you're on TV, why not take a shot at a place that might have an epic crowd? Like, worst case scenario is still better than 3,000 in 110,000.
So venue, not location, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's a, you know, perception is reality, and playing somewhere smaller, I think that's something you can do. That's why Hofstra looks great. Like, even with 5,000, it looks great, and it's a good location. So I feel like just take a risk at one of them and just, you know, kind of like find a way to partner up with those MLS stadiums. Like, look at Atlanta, right? They get 60,000 people going to their soccer games inside a stadium that holds 80, and it looks awesome. I just feel like, you know, take some kind of risk. Ohio State's not a risk. I just think it'd be so cool. I mean, I don't watch MLS soccer, but when the Portland Timbers are playing, I'll take a look and see that crowd and see them all into it. I just feel like there's some way to do it. So that's where I'd like to see a game, maybe Austin, Texas, get Matthew McConaughey out there doing his thing, like just something unique.
All right.
You know, I think that'd be cool. So you pick your two stadiums for your quarterfinals right now.
Yeah.
Next year, where would you want to see him?
I mean, that's tough. I like the small stadiums. Like, if you have to, I know logistically it's tough because you have to pick them in advance, or at least that's the theory. Yeah. You know, I would probably go with, like, I like Penn State. I like what Ohio State's building there. I like Michigan's. I like, you know, obviously the traditional, like, you know, Klockner. I like Notre Dame. That's a cool venue. It usually looks pretty packed on TV. You know, I think those, like, 2,000 to 4,000 person venues, and Or you're playing at the higher seed and you're letting that program really dictate the success of the event because they've built a fan base and they do a good job marketing the program, which, I mean, some programs do a great job of, some places don't. You look at like, all right, so like a Marquette, when they hosted UNC back in, I mean, they brought in stands on both sides. They blew it up. There were like kegs all over the place. The kids had no idea what they're watching, but they came out in full force and it was like a big time event. It looked that way and it was snowing on television. So like, I really think it comes down to how much sweat equity's put into it from the hosting program. And, you know, it doesn't matter how much effort you put in the shoe, like you're not going to fill that up unless you're playing before a spring game and there's 70,000 people in the stands at halftime because it's first come first serve seedings, which is what I got a chance to play in. That was pretty cool. They're chanting OHIO and they had no idea what they're watching. Like they thought we were out there with fishing nets. I think that's changed a little bit, but not all that much. So let's move on. Hopkins, your alma mater, hires John Crawley after the, what I would consider a surprise exit from John Grant Jr., who we had the pleasure of speaking with on this podcast earlier this season. Your thoughts on that hire?
Yeah. And first off, I love John Grant Jr. He's a close friend of mine. One of my all time favorite teammates, guy I got to coach with, play with, you know, really wish nothing but the best for him and his family. The great news is, as I believe he's liking Baltimore. I told him, I was able to speak with him afterwards and said, get your butt back out here to Denver so we can start hanging out again. But his family's happy where they are, which is great. And as a Hopkins alumni and a guy who knows John Crowley, I'm a huge fan of this hire. I think for many different reasons. One, I think it's been a while that I can think of, maybe since Benson was hired back in 07, that Hopkins had like this young coach that seems like an exciting hire, someone that's trying to make a name for themselves in the coaching ranks, someone that's still playing professionally, which I think helps, could also hurt a little bit with recruiting, but certainly helps with having someone who's still, you know, playing, still someone you can watch on TV, but hurts in the sense that maybe they can't always be out there on the recruiting trail because they do have responsibilities as a player. But he's a younger guy that is extremely well respected by his former teammates and tons of alumni. So I think that helps bring back some of that alumni connection as well. And also like the traditions, like that was the main driving force behind me going to Hopkins was the tradition of the program. And I think it's been a while since they've been successful and people slowly start forgetting about those traditions or the pride in the program and the reasons why kids do choose that school over Ivy League schools where maybe the education is a little bit better or Big Ten or ACC schools that have all of the different sports teams and massive facilities. That tradition is what is the driving force behind Johns Hopkins lacrosse. And I think he's a guy that can bring that out. So I'm excited. I'm excited for him. It's a great move. I know he was, you know, probably very happy at Lehigh, and you know, it's something that might look at the moment as a lateral move in terms of the success of each program's currently. I just, as an alum in a very biased position, I just feel like the ceiling is so much higher at Johns Hopkins and the future of the program. And I'm excited for him. I'm excited for the Blue Jays, the current team, the guys coming in. So I am definitely too thumbs up.
I love that. I appreciate the way you feel. The fact that you just consider that a potentially a lateral move speaks volumes about where like the alumni base views where the program is as a whole, in my opinion.
We had a losing season last year, right?
I think it just takes a long time to get the train back on the tracks. And I know that you know that. I'm not sure Hopkins alums in general understand how much time it takes, especially after COVID, you know, and obviously there are some issues with this, you know, situation, you know, and for whatever reason, John Grant Jr. moves on. But, you know, I think it just takes time. And that is, I would not consider this a lateral move at all. It's not the current state of the program. It's the potential of where the program could be in my eyes. And that's not a knock on Lehigh. I mean, they've been to the tournament multiple times. Coach Cassis has done a phenomenal job there, but Hopkins is, and maybe it's just a generational thing. Like the kids coming up now don't maybe not view it that way, but I would say like Hopkins is right in the mecca of the sport. You are right in Baltimore. You have beautiful facilities. You have all the tradition, but you don't flip a switch anywhere and just automatically the success comes. Like, especially again, under the circumstances of when they were hired and what they had to undertake in terms of turning it around. I mean, Coach Petro's acknowledged that their recruiting was not great and for whatever reason. He didn't get into details, but he's on, another podcast talking on that. And you know, to admit that you didn't do something as well as you could have, I mean, now it's the next staff's ability to turn that around and look at, like, what do we need to do differently? But you don't get new kids there right away. And even the kids that you have, they've been taught one thing, one way to think. The culture is in place. I mean, I don't believe that you really get a good sense of what a coaching staff is capable of until year six. And I think you start to think, and alums can start to think, year three, year four, you're like, oh yeah, you know, this is what we're going to get moving forward. And I don't think that could be further from the truth. I think any coach that has gone through that situation could tell you. You're starting to evaluate talent sophomore, junior year, right? Takes 2 years to get those kids into your program at all. And then you haven't developed your leaders for 6 years. Like 6 years until your recruited players are your leaders and your culture's in place. And then you just start to see what you're really capable of. Now, sometimes that's expedited, but I mean, going to the hire, I mean, I think everybody speaks, you know, very, very highly of John Crawley. He's had a tremendous career as a player. And I think he's a highly regarded coach. You know, what I'll say is, like, this is going to be evaluated and people are going to feel how they feel based on the success and how the offense is. Everybody's excited because this is a Hopkins guy. And I think he has every opportunity and perfectly capable of coming in and do some things. But if people think that the offense is going to be three goals better next spring, I think that's crazy. I think it's going to take longer than that. I think it's going to take a staff effort. And I think the other thing you look at is he taking over the offense and having full autonomy to run what he wants and how he wants to run it? Or is he coming in to run Coach Millman's offense that they've started to implement? I mean, you're looking at a new process if it's the former. And even if it's the latter, you're looking at another process of him learning kind of what he's coaching, what he's teaching. That won't take that long, but, you know, I think the jury will be out, not on just this hire, but on the staff as a whole. And I think people are pulling the trigger on judging, you know, what this staff has done to this point too early. Cause I think that the challenge that they had from the get-go was substantial. I think Jameson Kester came in as a very highly regarded assistant that had proven that he could take a group of players at UMBC that is a hard place or harder place to recruit and turn them into a top five unit, where I don't know that Coach Crawley has done that, but every alum is very excited about the hire because he's a young, bright guy who I think everyone's confident can do it at a high level. So you guys as alums will feel how you feel next year, and whether that's fair or not is how I'll say this will be evaluated, where I think you won't know who John Crawley is and who Coach Millman is from as the head coach of Johns Hopkins until, you know, probably three more years.
Well, first off, I feel a little misquoted. When I meant lateral, I just meant in the sense of where the teams were this season and last season, not in the tradition and the history of the programs. Obviously, I think the ceiling is way higher at Hopkins. And in my firm belief is when you talk about teams as the potential of winning national championships, like, I think you actually need to win a national championship before you can really talk about that. Like, in my mind, Notre Dame is not really ever a contender until they actually do it. That kind of thing. Like, Georgetown was the 2 seed this year, and I was all about Georgetown, but it's been a while, right? For a program like that. And they'll be better next year, obviously, even if their team isn't as talented, and they probably actually will be more talented. But they'll be better from the loss this year in that first round. So I think, you know, Hopkins and Syracuse, who had a horrendous season, Michelle, you know, they're going to be phenomenal teams, and they're going to get in there with the transfer portal. And that's what I want to see out of Hopkins. I know that when COVID hit and we didn't have a head coach, Millman got hired after all these significant things had happened in the transfer portal. So I think we missed out on that big time. And I'm hoping that the administration is going to allow for us to be aggressive in that portal and go after some guys that this offseason. And that's what I think a lot of people are hoping to see, especially as the Ivy Leagues finish their seasons and there's uncertainty in some of those kids' futures. So they do end up leaving. So I think that's why you want to see success in less than 6 years, because you can be aggressive with the transfer portal and you can reload year after year, like Maryland did this year after graduating arguably one of the best players in the history of college lacrosse. Their offense is better this year when they went in there and they snagged a guy like Donville and Keegan Kahn from other programs. So with the transfer portal now, I think you can do things a lot quicker.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think, you know, even on the flip side of that, like having guys in your roster that you don't necessarily feel like are in the boat, you know, it takes time to get those guys out. And you can do that in a positive way. But you're still like, it doesn't matter what we do. Like, we're not going to get complete buy-in from these guys because they were following a different leader before. And yeah, I agree. I don't think that there's many better situations from like, if you're in the transfer portal or if you're looking for a grad program or if you're a highly touted high school recruit, like to play a primary role in bringing this program back, what I think would be like an incredible experience. And there will be tons of trials and tribulations through that process, and it won't be easy, but I know that's probably what this coaching staff is trying to convince these kids of, and I think it'd be a really cool thing to do. So you know, and quite frankly, for the sport's sake, I hope that they do get back in the national conversation, because, you know, like I said, back in when I was learning the sport and what it was and watching, what got me excited about it was watching, you know, that program in Princeton. And so going back to the glory days, I would love to see, and I'm coming to watch you play in the Final Four, you know, like I remember that vividly as a really cool experience. And I always loved, and I was at the Hopkins, Maryland 100 anniversary game. Place was packed. I was wearing a Hopkins hat. I didn't know why, but I thought it was cool. And I'd like to see them come back and do good things. I know we don't have a ton of time, but let's touch on these openings. Providence, NJIT, St. John's, you know, obviously Lehigh offensive coordinator now. Your thoughts on any of these?
Yeah, I think there's a ton of great assistant coaches out there. And if I was these athletic directors at those schools, I would certainly wait until the season ends. I know there's guys out there right now that are great options that I'm sure they're speaking with, but you see a ton in college lacrosse. And we've talked to a bunch of assistants on this podcast about it, right? When you're an assistant coach and you win a national championship, you are typically first on a lot of teams' lists. But I do believe there's some coaches out there that whose seasons are over, who are also great options as well, right? I think John Galloway is someone that stands out in a lot of people's mind as a front runner, right? If I'm not mistaken, he was even an assistant coach at one time at Providence during his career when he was moving around before he landed at Jacksonville. But, you know, he had a very good season at Jacksonville. I'm sure he would have loved to have been in the tournament to kind of solidify what he's done so far there. But I don't know if Providence is a step up from Jacksonville right now when you look at it, right? He's having success for the first time. He's building something that players and recruits want to be a part of. He's getting good transfers to come in and make immediate impacts, which I think is important. And they built a brand new facility there. So it seems like the school is all in. And from what we've heard from a bunch of different assistant coaches, is that when they do move on and make that step to a head coach at a different program, they want buy-in and they want support from the university, which, you know, it's crazy to think, but it doesn't always happen, right? Second, lacrosse is sometimes treated as a secondary sport. And you want to make sure that president, that athletic director believes in you wanting to have success and that they want to be a part of that. So if I'm a guy like Galloway with the current openings, I'm probably happy where I am, but For some of these other coaches, right? I think Bobby Benson's a name that comes up. I know early on, maybe a decade ago, when he was looking to move on to become a head coach, you know, he went through the process and went through some interviews, but now he seems like a guy that could, with the way they play offense at Maryland, that he could potentially snag any role that he wants.
Did he decline that job? Because I remember I heard that he declined it. Or
I don't know. So I'm not going to say, but how can you watch Maryland's offense right now and deny what he's doing there? And yes, they did mention that it's part of Coach Tillman's brainchild of this set free, no play offense and making it work. But Benson is the guy running it. And he took players who were great players with a high IQ and skill level that came in this year and just filled roles with like what seemed to be seamless. Like they were there the whole time, which is just crazy impressive. And I still believe I could score a couple goals a game if you inserted me in that Maryland offense right now. So I just truly believe in what he's doing and feel like it would be crazy to think that he can't be a guy taking a head coaching job if he wants to lead. Same with Bernhardt, right? Jesse, the defensive coordinator at Maryland, same thing. Their defense is incredible. And clearly, you know, not just with the talent that they have, but with the schemes that they're playing. So he's another guy that I would put in that mix. And then we have our boy, Mikey Thompson, who unfortunately the Christopher Newport season ended in overtime. But, you know, you can't deny his ability to build a program, right? We talked about it. He stepped on the CNU campus as an assistant coach 10 years ago, and in 10 years got them to the Final Four with only being the head coach there for now six seasons. So he's – when you're looking at the D2 and D3 head coaches that could make that jump to Division I, he's got to be a name that stands out on a lot of people's lists. So those are my guys. You know, I would obviously put Coach Petro on that list as well. I just think, how can you not be excited at Syracuse right now with the incoming class that they have? That seems like it's incredible. And now dominating the transfer portal, really, I think it's going to be a quick turnaround for those guys from their 4-10 season.
They're losing their best player.
To what happened.
They're losing their best player.
Yeah, but no, they're losing their best goal scorer. All right, Curry was definitely the best player on that team in my mind. I think he's going to have an outstanding career. But he's gone. Yeah, he's gone. But I mean, you're telling me Spolina's not going to step right in and have 60 or 70 points next year? And some of the pieces, some of the guys are picking up.
I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is they're losing their best returning player. So.
They are losing their best returning player, but they are getting a generational talent in the freshman that's coming in, and they already have some pieces around them. And we also forget that what's that Canadian, the kid wearing 77, the lefty attackman that didn't get to play this year?
Hiltz,
right? I mean, that kid was, everyone knew he was about to have an incredible season. So now you get him back in the mix too. You know, I think the Syracuse fans got a little smile on their face, even though they just had their worst season ever. I think they're all very excited about the future. What about you? Who do you got out there? Who are your,
well, I didn't have Benson cause I think it's up to him. I mean, I think he's probably had the opportunity if he wanted it to grab a lot of head coaching positions. But it's just, you know, like, again, to your point, we talked to these assistants about what they would need in order to go. And a lot of things need to be lined up for somebody to go take a head coaching position. You know, you are looking at a tough conference to go compete in for a rebuild. But I think Providence is a place where you can do it. And I mean, their stadium's incredible. They have
every unruly fans. Oh man, I played at Providence my sophomore year. They were saying things about my brother Mike that I don't even know where they got that information. It's like they called my mom the night before the game to talk about his high school girlfriend. It was incredible and extremely impressive at the same time.
Yeah, no, I mean, so I think it's a place you can have success, and it'll be really interesting what direction they go. I mean, Benson definitely, I tweeted out some of the guys that I thought would be a good fit from an assistant standpoint. We used to joke around, you could start a rumor, just like a false rumor in the lacrosse world during the coaching carousel, and just, you'll put a stopwatch on and see how quickly it kind of came back to you. Cause like you could just, it's just anything you said, you could hear, you'd hear the next day, especially on the road. So I don't know how true this is, but I'm hearing they're throwing out some pretty big money, like 250 to the head coach, which I think is something that can attract a very good coach, a current head coach, and not just assistants. But in terms of the assistants that I would look at, Jim Mitchell at Princeton, I think he had that brief stint at Bellarmine. I think has been ready and he's eager to be a head coach. Casey Broderson at Bryant, which guy gets no, he's not get talked about much, has run.
Are you going to invite him to be on the show?
Only because they were competing with Hobart for so long and the arch bitter rival. I don't know. I couldn't bite on it, but we need to do that. Cause he's a stud of a coach, been the defensive coordinator there for a long time, and they've gone to the NCAA tournament and beat Syracuse in the first round and competed well with Maryland. So he's a guy that and has learned under one of the best in Pressler. Paul Richards, who's been a big part of Coach Shamadi down at Richmond. I think he's kind of a silent assassin, a guy that nobody talks about, but it can probably run a very, very good program, can clearly run a very good defense right now and has proven that over the years. I think he's a guy that should get an opportunity somewhere. Eric Saramet at Rutgers was the head coach at Air Force when they were having a ton of success and just been doing it a long time. Now he's running a Rutgers offense that is very good. So he's been around the block. Mike Phipps, younger guy. Obviously, we had him on. He's awesome. You know, familiarity with the Big East. Sean Kerwin and Wellner at Notre Dame. You know, he was at Navy for a long time, highly regarded in the industry for being a guy that's highly respected and, you know, has kind of been, you know, close to running a program in terms of the responsibilities and roles that he's been in throughout his coaching career. So, I mean, there's tons of good options. And I don't think you can go wrong with any of those guys. And there's others out there that I think would fit, but those are the guys that I would point to. Obviously, you know, Mikey Thompson and Galloway and the guys you mentioned, I think could also do a good job. But, you know, I think, again, you're looking at a six-year contract commitment from Providence to see whoever they hire, how good of a job he can do. You smile when I'm saying that.
Six years, $1.5 million. I'm going to tweet that out and we'll see how many people reach out and say, where'd you get those facts as they're all applying for the job right now?
Yeah. Well, we'll find out which direction they go, but NJIT, I think they have success in a lot of their other sports. I mean, I don't know that they've made progress there. And same thing with St. John's, but I think you'll see two very hungry young assistants that are just ready to run their own programs, take the leap and go try to prove themselves at those two institutions. And, you know, I've never been to NJIT, but I know it's a place you can recruit engineers, and they just built this incredible facility that I think it would be a nice recruiting tool as well. And at St. John's, we went to once, and I really got no feel for what the school has to offer or what the campus is like or any of that stuff. But
you know, I think St. John's, you just need like a Long Island guy that, you know,
grinder.
I would go with like a Chanichuk. Steal him from Stony Brook, a young guy that can build a program that, you know, I think could recruit well. That would be my outside pick for someone like that. But I think you need some kind of Long Island dude with the.
I may go JP Brazzle, who's at Stony Brook, same on that same staff, but was at Hofstra and kind of been around, coached at Delaware, coached it. I mean, I think he could probably go there and. You know, knows how to run a program, knows probably has coached both sides of the ball. And I know he's a good goalie coach too. So that's a guy that may be in the running there, but yeah, I think you're going to see a lot more movement too. I mean, this isn't going to stop anytime soon. So pretty cool summer ahead. But first we get to watch this dynamic Final Four and hopefully somebody gives Maryland a game. Princeton's going to pull the upset.
All right. I like that pick. And
go Tigers.
We are bringing on the assistant coaches of the national champions for our next show.
Yeah. Well, good catching up, man. And we will talk next week.
Sounds
good. Everybody enjoy the Final Four.
Let's ride.